Remarks of the President, Albany, New York, 10 October 1952.
A friend of ours who lived in our midst for many years and was one of us, the former governor of our state, the present United States Senator, Herbert H. Lehman.
Friends and neighbors of Albany, I want to tell you how happy I am to be back here at home again. 14 happiest years of my life was spent here in the city of Albany in your midst. In a minute, you're going to hear from the great president. Harry S. Truman will go down in history as one of the great chief executives of our country. I want to speak to you just for a minute with regard to the importance and necessity of sending to Washington a
gentlemen of Albany. I am very happy to be back here again. I served 30 years ago in the Capitol as a Democratic Assemblyman. And I want to say this, Dan O'Connell has been a great friend and a staunch supporter of mine. And I think that when I am elected the next United States Senator, Albany will be my second home. And so, I say to you, I present now the President of the United States.
Thank you very, very much. It's always good to visit Albany, which is a real democratic country. You voted democratic in the presidential elections ever since 1928, and just this a special election, you had the good sense to send Leo. He ran on the democratic margin, so send him back again. I also urge you, Cashmore, of the Senate House, and John Cashmore in the Senate, be represented in Washington as you ought to be. The Democratic Party is going to win this November. Making this trip to help in the election of two fine candidates for president and vice president. These are men who have proved they understand the Democratic Party's role in making this country the great place it is, Adlai Stevenson and John Sparkman. And I'm also trying to convince the people that it would be a great mistake to elect the Republican candidate for president. There was a time when I thought the present Republican candidate was qualified to be president. I realized, of course, that he would have trouble in political life, as all military men do. But I thought I could rely on his integrity. I believed he would always stand up for things he had worked so hard to achieve. Whatever else happened, I thought he would defend the international policies that he had done so much in his military career to help create and put into effect, I thought he would stand firmly behind the great defense effort we are making to hold off communist aggression and prevent World War III. I thought he could be relied on to give firm support to our allies and to the brave men who are struggling against aggression in Korea. My friends, that is not the case, I'm sorry to say. At one time, he advocated budget cuts in our national defense program more extreme than those advocated by Senator Taft. The size of his proposed cuts varies from speech to speech, and I don't know what the quotation is today, but it doesn't make any difference. Everything he's proposed would be a crippling blow to our defense program and would undo much of the work that is now going forward. By attacking our efforts in Korea and calling them a blunder, he has raised questions that strike a blow at the morale of the free nations fighting there. I never thought I would see a general doing anything that could weaken the morale and faith of our country in the cause for which we are fighting at the very time when our troops are locked in battle with the enemy. These and other developments have led me to the firm conclusion that the Republican candidate is not qualified to be president. If he can't withstand the political pressures of a campaign any better than this, he will not be able to withstand the far greater pressures that beat upon a president in office. I've had some experience with these pressures, and I think I know what I'm talking about. My disillusionment with this general has led me to go back and study the role of other generals in our politics, and I've come to the firm conclusion that we should always keep civilians at the head of our government. I think this was intended by the Constitution. I think that history proved that professional generals should not be presidents. We've had many fine generals in our history. They've been great and able men who have lived a life of real public service, but they can render that service best in the military life for which they were trained. Military training and military life do not qualify a man to be president. A president has to learn about politics and civil government from experience. Only a man who understands politics thoroughly can keep from being imposed upon and pushed around and used as a tool by politicians. A man who spends all his life in the army can't possibly learn the business of political life. He has too much else to do. Furthermore, the military life is almost the opposite of political life. A good many of you have been in the armed forces and know how different army life is. In the army, a general gets things done by giving orders, but that is not the way the government works. A president can't order the people of the United States around. Most good military leaders recognize that their training does not qualify them for the presidency. Most of them follow the tradition of keeping out of politics. One of our great generals once put this idea very well in words I shall read to you. He said, "Politics is a profession, a serious, complicated, and in its true sense, a noble one. In the American scene, I see no dearth of men fitted by training, talent, and integrity for national leadership. On the other hand, nothing in the international or domestic situation especially qualifies for the most important office in the world, a man whose adult years have been spent in the country's military forces. At least this is true in my case." That statement, my friend, was made 4 years ago by the man who is now the Republican candidate for president. It was true then, and it's true today. There's another good reason why a professional general should not become president. One of the basic principles of our government is that it should be under civilian control. The military arm of the government exists to serve the people. It should never rule them. A professional soldier in the White House might give the military undue power in our government. Another famous general put this danger very well, and he said, and I quote, "It would be a tragic development indeed if this generation was forced to look to the rigidly military dominance and discipline. Nothing is more conducive to arbitrary rule than the military junta. It might well destroy our historic and wise concept." Which holds to the supremacy of the civil power. The gravity of this danger cannot be overestimated. Now, those words were spoken by General Douglas MacArthur. And I certainly agree with him that a civilian president is needed to hold the generals in their proper place in our form of government, and I think I've amply demonstrated that myself. Our political history proves that it is a great mistake to send a professional military man to the White House. In all our history, we have elected a purely professional military man to the presidency only on two occasions. We've elected other men who had fine military records and who had been generals, like Washington and Jackson and Garfield. But they were not regular army men. They were civilians first, lawyers or legislators second. They were lawyers and legislators, and soldiers second. We've had only two lifelong Army men in the White House. The first was Zachary Taylor, who had been in the Army 40 years. He was a hero of the Mexican War. He was inaugurated in 1849 and died a year and a half later at the age of 65. In his campaign, he made a lot of promises about cleaning up the government and doing away with political patronage. After he was elected, he doled out more political jobs than his predecessors and restored the spoils system. Instead of cleaning up corruption, he increased it. He was succeeded by a vice president, Millard Fillmore, who made a very unpopular president, I'm sorry to say, because he came from New York. The second and last professional military man elected to the presidency was General Grant. He had two terms from 1869 to 1877. He gave the country the most corrupt administration it ever had in all its history. He was a fine general. He was personally honest, but a complete failure as president. The politicians led him around by the nose and got him to give them anything they wanted. In fact, both those generals were babes in the woods when it came to politics. They were set up by the political leaders of the Whig Party and the Republican Party to bamboozle the people, and they used him. Very interesting to study why and how generals have been chosen as candidates for president. In addition to the two regular generals who were successful, three regular army generals have run and been defeated. In almost every case, the general was nominated by a political party that was hopelessly divided into factions or on the wrong side of all the issues. Political leaders are never willing to let a general have the nomination if they think their party has a good chance of winning the election on its merits. They want the presidency for themselves. The politicians nominate generals in the hope that military glamour will fool the people and keep them from thinking about the issues. There are a lot of examples of this, but I have time only to mention a few. The Whig Party was probably the worst offender in this matter of nominating generals. The Whig Party was the successor of the old Federalist Party and the ancestor of the Republican Party today. The Whigs were always disunited and divided. They started in the 1820s, and about the only thing they could agree on was that they hated Andrew Jackson, who was, of course, a Democrat. They were the party that put up General William Henry Harrison in 1840. He was a regular army general, but he had also served a good part of his life in civil government. However, he was picked for his reputation as a hero of the wars against the Indians. That was one of the wildest campaigns in our history. That was the Tippecanoe and Tyler II campaign. The Whigs never talked about a single issue. They didn't even have a platform. And nobody knew where this general stood on anything except that he was against the Democrats. They bamboozled the people with the general's glamour and a lot of ballyhoo, and he was elected. But he died almost as soon as he was inaugurated. It worked so well in 1840 that the Whigs tried it again in 1848 with General Zachariah Taylor. It was the same story then. The Whig Party was hopelessly divided into two factions. They couldn't agree on the issues, and again, they had no platform, so they nominated a general who'd never cast a vote in his life and whose views, if he had any, were completely unknown. The Whig Party tried the same stunt in 1852, just 100 years ago. But by this time, the people were beginning to catch on. In that year, the Whigs eliminated all the candidates who had ever taken a position on any issue and nominated another Mexican war hero, General Winfield Scott. He was known as Old Fuss and Feathers. The Democrats beat the tar out of him. And that, by the way, was the end of the Whig Party. It fell apart after the election and soon expired. In 1864, the Democratic Party in the North was in a weak position. They wanted to capitalize on the people's weariness with the Civil War without appearing unpatriotic. So they picked an army general who hated Lincoln, General McClellan. But he was defeated, and that certainly was a good thing for the country. The Democratic Party in 1864 was a lot like the Republican Party today. The isolationist Republicans now want to make an issue out of Korea and our whole policy of checking communist aggression without appearing to be unpatriotic. So they're using a general to front for them. That's the way it goes all through our history. Whenever you see a regular general as a party's candidate, you know the politicians in that party are desperate, that the party is so unpopular or so divided, they think they can't win without military glamour. That's exactly the situation in the Republican Party today. The Republicans haven't won a national election in 20 years, and I hope they don't win for another 20. Their policies are reactionary and out of step with the people. They can't possibly win on domestic issues, and they are hopelessly divided over foreign policy and very bitter to each other. At their convention, they were calling each other thieves and robbers. They are a desperate and divided minority party who can't go before the people and tell them what they really stand for. So they have used the old trick of desperate politicians and picked a regular army general to hide their own miserable record and take the people's minds off the issues. It's an old trick, and it's not going to work this time. Don't let them fool you. It's a good thing to study American history. It helps you to understand what is happening and to avoid getting fooled. So don't let this year, don't fall this year for one of the oldest political tricks in American history. It's your issue, it's your interests that are at stake. You're the government. The power of government under our Constitution lies with the people. And the way you exercise that power is by voting in election time. All of you ought to be registered so you can vote and show what you believe in politics, what you want for your own interest and for the interest of this country and for the welfare of the whole free world. It's necessary for you to inform yourself on the issues. I've gone across this country from one end of it to the other, and I've told the people where the Democratic Party stands and what the Democratic Party has done for the country. Now, the Republicans have not yet stated what they're for. They've only stated that they're against the Democrats. Now, use your judgment. Vote the Democratic ticket on November the 4th, and the country will be safe for another 4 years. Now, I have with me what I consider...